ready to hear argument in 031066, Arkoma Basin Exploration Company versus FMF Associates.
May I please report? Mr. P. Michael Young and Mr. David M. Gunn will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. David M. Gunn will open with the first 5 minutes. Mr. P. Michael Young will present the rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This oil and gas fraud case presents the court with four issues: a waiver issue, the substantive issue behind waiver, damages, and the sufficiency of the evidence; a liability question, which split the Court of Appeals 2-1, and a procedural question about appellate timetables. I intend to address issue one, the waiver issue, and I will not dwell on the written arguments, which I think are well-developed by both sides. The court has that. In fact, you've had it twice now with the Samudan case that came up a few years ago. I would like to stress the jurisprudential importance of that issue to real-world practice, because we're asking for rendition on two alternate grounds, one being damages, the other being liability. And if you choose to rule in our favor, we'd ask the court to consider basing that reversal on damages. Dealing with the Samudan problem is quite important to the jurisprudence of the state. I assure you, this result would have been different in Houston, where I practice in the Court of Appeals regularly. It would not have turned out this way. For 15 years, I have preserved no evidence points with straight-up one-sentence assertions of no evidence and have had no trouble. It was not until the Samudan case and now the Arkoma case that there began to be a problem. And we need uniformity, and I respectfully suggest to the court, we need it as quickly as possible.
Can't we tell what they would have ruled on the legal sufficiency point, since they proceeded to say on the remediator question there was factually sufficient evidence of damages?
I think you have some insight into it. I can't tell for sure.
Well, they couldn't. As a matter of absolute logic, if there's factually sufficient evidence, there's legally sufficient evidence. Couldn't be one without the other.
It's a little more complicated than in this case, because there are eight different plaintiffs, and they all have different numbers. And I'm not certain that that is correct. The trial judge seemed to think he understood it. I'm not certain he did. But I can't tell for certain what the Court of Appeals would have done. I can tell that the heart of our argument about sort of the Holt-Atherton complete calculation saying just it doesn't add up, that they didn't get there.
Because I'm interested in the issue, in remediator issues, the standard. Obviously, there was a lot of post-trial judge was addressing. No question he addressed all this stuff. He wrote a four-page letter about it and got a lot of letters, including one from the expert about, well, this is what I meant when I said that. Post-trial. But on remediator, at least since Larson, Judge Kilgarland said, well, we can't pay any attention to that. So help me understand. If the trial judge says, I'm worried that there's no evidence of damages. And plaintiff says, well, you know, we meant this. And then the expert who we're relying on sends a letter and says, no, I didn't mean that at all. Does the trial judge have to ignore that? Obviously, the trial judge could just grant a new trial, say, you know, I can tell from this guy's letter that's not what he meant. We're going to do this over again. But if you, as I understand under Larson, if you say, well, we can do it all over again because the expert admits that's not what he said, that's not what he meant. Would you rather have a remediator? Yeah, we'd rather have a remediator. And then when we review the remediator, we'd pay no attention to any of that because, after all, it wasn't during the trial. Why does that make sense?
Well, I'm not sure it makes perfect sense. Our scheme of legal and factual sufficiency, that construct imposes some artificial boundaries. And so when we go through a J&OB hearing, we don't get to talk about remediator at all, even though everybody may know that's the big elephant in the room. And when we go to the new trial hearing, we've already crossed the bridge of J&OV, and so we try to frame it in different terms. So we have this more or less artificial distinction, but it's the way things
shake out. Well, but as I understand, every other court in the country reviews remediators for abuse of discretion. And we did.
And we did. And I I have some misgivings about the Larson regime and the change away from abuse of discretion. Our hope is that if you look at the box of rocks and all the parts in the plaintiff's damage model, at the end of the day, this is not really a remittiture case, that you just can't get those rocks to add up to anything. Not just a smaller number than what the jury got, but not to anything. And that's what we're trying to get to. This is a discussion we ought to be having. This is a discussion we should have had in the Court of Appeals. And we partially had it in the trial court. After all the dust settles and the trial is over, to say, okay, did we get it right? Has the system produced an accurate result? And does this equation work? Is there evidence of whatever it is? Or else the burden of proof doesn't really mean as much as it's supposed to. The bottom of the waiver issue is really just a policy judgment. Let's get it right. And I'm going to yield the podium now and ask Mr. Young to jump into this, the substance of this damage question. And you will hear the same kind of argument the trial judge heard and clearly understood. So he was not being sandbagged. We just think the judge got it wrong.
May it please the court. The jury in this case sent out a note which said in part, we cannot locate evidence, exhibits, which reflect the actual value of the property at the time the contract was made and the value that the property would have possessed had the representation been true, if any. We stand before this court today with that same question in our minds. We know from Charbonneau and Polk versus Tenneco that there are three recognized methods of property valuation. What was attempted here was clearly not the comparable sales approach or the replacement cost approach. It most closely resembled the income approach. The plaintiff's expert testified to what he called lost reserves, that is, reserves that were allegedly represented to be there, less the reserves that, in his opinion, were actually there. But when you think about it, gas reserves being in the ground are actually an income stream, or more accurately, the prospect of an income stream.
Do we reach this fraud decision and calculation of damages under Virginia law if we decide the point's not waived, or do we remand that to the Court of Appeals? Because there will be a factual sufficiency determination at that level, right?
You decide it at this level as a straight-up legal sufficiency question. It is our position that there is no evidence of damages. And that is a question of Texas law because it's a question of the sufficiency of the evidence. Everyone agrees on the Virginia law measure of damages. The jury was instructed on that. There's no issue about that on appeal.
But why would we sort through all these issues of Virginia law instead of remanding to the Court of Appeals to let them do that?
Because the issue of damages is not an issue of Virginia law. It is an issue of Texas law. How you prove damages in a Texas court is an issue of Texas law, even if the measure of damages is defined by Virginia law. So this is a Texas law.
And how would we find that there's no evidence when the expert said, in my opinion, there's the value of these lost reserves is X million dollars?
The answer, Your Honor, is that this court said in Coastal, in Havner, going way back in Dallas Railway versus Gossett, that an expert's bare opinion like that is standing alone, no evidence.
But how in Helton, we said that as well. But in Helton, there was a long cross-examination that pointed out that the expert was just ignoring. He said they're the same when he admitted, in effect, on cross-examination, he had no basis for that. I mean, I'm looking at our rule, 705B, which says what the evidence of damages or anything else is proved. It says prior to the expert giving the opinion or disclosing the expert may testify in terms of opinion or inference and give the reasons, therefore, without prior disclosure of the underlying facts or data, unless the court requires otherwise. Wouldn't it be in your client's duty, if they wanted how those damages were calculated more specifically, to have asked those questions?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The rule deals with admissibility, and so it was admissible for him to say, in my opinion, the damages are X. If he had stopped there, This court's precedents say that is no evidence of damages.
Which one says that?
Coastal.
Wait a second. Coastal's not, none of those, Coastal, the guy just said this is grossly negligent.
Right.
Well, we don't need any help on that. We can look at the record and figure out from what happened and who did what and what they knew, whether there's gross negligence or not.
But
damages is different.
But
damages takes some calculations. Have we ever said that somebody couldn't just say the value of my house is $150,000?
I'm not aware of a precedent applying those general rules about expert testimony to damages. But what this court has said time and time again is that conclusory expert opinion is no evidence. The court said in Burrow that it is.
But we've also been criticized that what we're doing is helping lazy defense lawyers who sit there on their hands and say nothing, and then when the trial's all over and the experts have all gone home and the jury's discharged, then they come up and say, hey, they should have been more specific. Now, the ones that I joined with, I disagree with that on. But on this one, I mean, how much detail to go into the damages? Why shouldn't we put the burden on the defense lawyer to say, how'd you calculate?
Because the burden rests with the plaintiff as a matter of overriding burden of proof. Secondly, this court has said the fact that an expert thinks something, standing by itself, does not make that fact more probable or less probable and does not aid the jury in reaching a decision until it hears the basis for that opinion. And it is the basis for that opinion that gives the ultimate Birchfield opinion on the ultimate issue probative value. So if Mr. Harper had said, I've run the numbers and the damages are X, Y, and Z, thank you, I quit, that would have been no evidence of damages. It was not incumbent, it should not be incumbent on the defendant to say, well, now do you really know what you're talking about that or not? The expert has to explain, the plaintiff has to prove that the expert knew what he was talking about and followed and what the basis for that conclusion was.
What if they proved it at the pre-trial? Well, I took $1.60 and multiplied it times the reserves and $1.92 and multiplied it by the reserves.
That was perfectly adequate as far as it went, but then the question is, where did the $1.60 and the $1.92 come from?
Well, it's at what point does the defendant need to ask that question?
Once the expert has said, here is where the $1.60 and the $1.92 came from, and the places that it came from are the places that the law requires it to have come from. Under Maritime versus Ellis, the issue becomes, and Coastal, the issue becomes, is this a relevancy objection or is it a reliability objection? And if the expert has proved what he needs to prove, and I say, but it's unreliable, then indeed it is my burden at least to object. But if the expert has not proved what he needs to prove by more than just a say-so.
But what if he does not prove what he needs to prove because of a flaw in his methodology or the factors he uses?
Well, if it is, the word methodology is a tricky word. If it means that he has not done his work in a way that is peer-reviewed or that has an acceptable error rate.
Well, isn't that just the claim here, that you've used this method of valuation, but it's not an accepted methodology, it's unreliable, and therefore you have to challenge it at that level?
No, it is not the legally appropriate methodology. Let me give you an example. In a medical malpractice case, the expert says, in my opinion, the doctor was negligent. Well, what is the basis for that opinion, sir? Well, I went and I looked at all the dental manuals and I thought about what a reasonable dentist would do, and in my opinion, this was not what a reasonable dentist would do. There is no evidence there of medical doctor negligence, because what the expert has demonstrated is that the basis for his conclusory opinion, it does not meet the legal standards that it is required to meet what a reasonable doctor would do under the same or similar circumstances.
And you say Texas law controls those legal standards?
Texas law controls how you prove damages in a Texas court. Virginia law controls the measure of damages. but Texas law controls the sufficiency of the evidence of proof of a fact in a
so
Texas
So if Virginia court. Law did not require, for example, proof of a capitalization rate, we would have to take that into account.
That is right. That is right.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Cynthia Hollingsworth will present argument for the respondent.
This is really not a no evidence case. This is not a situation where the testimony of the amount of damages is conclusory on its face.
The judge certainly knew the complaint was that there was no evidence of damages. He wrote a 4-page letter to that effect.
I don't believe that letter reflects that the judge ever understood what the complaints were. There were various.
He understood the complaint was that the damages had not been proved very specifically or where the numbers came from. I mean, that's what the letter's about.
The letter is about the calculation of damages, but I don't think it's that there was no evidence of the damages. Here, there was evidence.
Well, then why did he grant a remittiture of several $1 million?
It's puzzling to me, Your Honor, the remittiture, to be honest. I've read the letter, and I still don't understand it.
He didn't think it was discounted to present value, did he?
I'm not sure, but it appears that that was what the basis of his the letter that you referenced.
And can we take into account in reviewing that, should the Court of Appeals have taken into account the expert's letter submitted to the court on the post-judgment motion saying, oh, yeah, I did, because what investors do apparently is take 8 years of value, and that's how they value reserves.
I think the court should take it into account in determining whether there was sufficient reliability of the expert. Here, the expert was challenged because he had reviewed data by third persons, which had not been previously
which you're not arguing on appeal.
And we're not arguing about that on appeal. That was the only challenge to this expert's testimony. The expert had, in fact, prepared reports which were not allowed at trial because they had not been timely filed. Nonetheless, the expert relied on that in coming to his conclusion. He could have testified in great detail at trial about those exhibits that the court considered a remittiture if he had been cross-examined. He was not cross-examined at trial. There was no objection to his testimony. The only objection was that this expert had relied on data, which is not an issue in this appeal.
Let me ask you this. You have a jury verdict, and you have a judgment that's based on that verdict. And the losing party comes in and says, with respect to each finding that supports the verdict, no evidence to support question number one, no evidence to support question number two. That is how they intend to preserve error. Does that preserve a legal sufficiency complaint or not? And if it doesn't, then what sort of detail must a party go to preserve that error?
Okay. Generally, an objection would preserve a no-evidence point. But here, the point I'm trying to get across is this is not really a no-evidence point, in that there was evidence to support the jury finding.
Okay, the answer to my question, just on a technical preservation point, is if you've got no-evidence objections to each of those findings, that preserves a legal sufficiency complaint. Is that right?
I don't think so without qualifying it, Your Honor. And the point is here, they're coming in and challenging under the... Well, yes, Your Honor, it would preserve it. And I guess my point is this isn't really a no-evidence point. They're coming in trying to, based on this court's decision and Coastal, no doubt, trying to come in the back door and challenge the methodology and technique and calculations that the expert used to arrive at his opinion, which covers about 3 volumes of testimony, by saying this is a no-evidence point. And it's taken many forms and fashions throughout these proceedings as to what the no-evidence was, but even if you look at the briefs in the Court of Appeals, and even if you look in the briefs in this case, and read what the complaint is that, well, this really isn't evidence of the value, or this isn't a correct measure of the value, or this is not good testimony.
Is cross-examine necessary when the expert's opinion doesn't meet the legal standard?
I think there are cases that hold you do not have to cross-examine an expert if there is absolutely no testimony or no evidence, if it's completely conclusory.
It's obviously a risk the lawyer takes.
It's a risk the lawyer takes. But
which he or she can cover by making the type of objection that was made post-trial, right? The no evidence?
Well, if the objection is that this is not evidence of the benefit of the bargain damages, perhaps. But here, it's the objection is that the methodology that was used to arrive at the expert's opinion, that objection had to be made at trial. That goes back to the reason for Robinson. On the one hand, for the court is a gatekeeper to keep out unreliable testimony. But more importantly, this court has held that if you're if your challenge is to the methodology, you've got to object at trial.
In Havner, there was no objection during trial.
No, but in Havner, there was cross-examination, and in Havner, that was a case where the expert testimony did not prove or was not probative of the fact that it was offered.
Counsel, if I can go back to the Chief Justice's question.
Yes, which I'm not sure I fully answered.
I'm reading the motion for under tab 5 here, the defendant's motion for JNOV and to disregard. There is, for example, here a statement, there is no evidence of damages other than speculative damages which are not recoverable as a matter of law. That's DE. There is no evidence of the actual value at the time of the purchase on which to base damages for benefit of the bargain. Now, do you agree that preserves error for us to review the no evidence points on damages?
Yes, I do.
Now, let me take it one step further, if I might, and go back to the Chief Justice's question, because that's the same.
May I explain this just for a second? I agree that you can consider those points, but you've got to go further and see if the points are really that there is no evidence or that the methodology...
Sure, I understand that, but the preservation of error. Had that objection or the NOV point been simply there is no evidence to support the damages finding, would that, in your opinion, preserve error for us to review the damages no evidence point?
If it were truly a no evidence point as opposed to a challenge to the methodology and the underlying basis for the expert's opinion.
To clarify that, the Court of Appeals said the objections raised in the motions must be specific enough to call the trial court's attention to the precise lack of sufficiency asserted upon appeal. And you would disagree with that if, as you say, it were really a no evidence point.
Right. And
but you think it's broader here because
I do.
It gets into the no man's land between no evidence and whether the opinion is just conclusory or unreliable.
Right, and I'm not sure the Court of Appeals, I think the Court of Appeals got it right. I'm not sure that it should have cited some Eden or that the Court of Appeals reasoning was exactly right. But here, this point is not preserved for appeal because it's a point that needed to be made at the trial court level and was not made until later.
And could I ask you one more question,
yes,
and I'm
sure.
Going to leave it alone. What is your understanding of the appellate bar's thinking in regard to this? A generic, no evidence point on a motion for or a JNOB would preserve for appellate review the no evidence contention?
Well, I don't know that I can speak for the entire appellate bar, but I think when you want to challenge an expert, you need to either have a Robinson hearing, you need to object to the
just testimony. Just the no evidence. And I'm not asking for speaking for the appellate bar. I was just asking for your understanding of what the general thinking is. Is a generic no evidence claim in a JNOV enough to preserve the no evidence issue for review on appeal?
A no evidence claim in a judgment.
There is no evidence of damages. Mm-hmm. That's enough to preserve.
To preserve a no evidence complaint on appeal.
If it's a true no evidence.
If it's a true no evidence complaint.
Thank you.
So now, a true no evidence. Plaintiff puts a personal injury case, puts a doctor on the stand. Future medical expenses are going to be $500,000. Nothing more, no objection, nobody says anything. Post-trial, no evidence. Doctor just says $500,000 future medical. We can see the plaintiff. We know what the problem is.
No,
he's got
L2
and L3 and whatever it is. But he doesn't break it down into operation by operation and how much, etc. Is that enough, or what can we review on appeal?
That might be enough. It's similar to the situation discussed in the Maritime dissent. Well, no, not really. In the Maritime dissent, maybe it was a little bit stronger. But that's not the situation that we have here. We have volumes of testimony regarding what he relied, the theory.
You say that, but in my review of the briefs, I only saw pages 105 through 108 of Harper's testimony being the only thing anybody cited in their briefs has been where he explained what the damages were.
That may be the only site we have in this court, Your Honor. But first of all, Barb testified as to the methodology to be used in evaluating the quantity of the reserves.
But Harper was the only one that said,
and then Harper,
this is the amount of money.
Right. And I believe that testimony, and I can provide a
if you send me a post.
Because
all I could find in the briefs was these four pages, and without x-ray glasses, I can't.
Some of the testimony from Harper is correct about his methodology. Some of it is implicit. And it was not our duty to use the magic words capitalization rate or how the methodology
works. So how do we draw the line when the doctor gets on the stand and says $500,000 future medical? Is that conclusory? Does the plaintiff have to say more than that? If so, how much
maybe not in that
more
case,
detail?
I think that's what's tough about this case.
Help us understand. We've never written on this. What is the line on damages between conclusory and no evidence and methodology?
Well, the court's written on it a little bit in the dissent in Maritime. And I think that when you have to look at the basis for the opinion, and that's what R.C. versus Burrow says in several other cases, including, I believe, Havner. And I think that you look at whether there's any basis in the facts and the supporting record to support what would otherwise be a conclusory opinion, because it's the basis for the expert's opinion that gives it its probative value.
So when he says this is going to have to be a future surgery, it's going to cost $75,000, we have to ask him, all right, now how many hospitals did you survey? How many?
Your Honor, you're going to keep adding another procedure to this and pass me
well,
to draw
I'm,
the line.
Well, I'm concerned. And I mean, for years in personal injury, doctors have done nothing more than that. They've gotten on the stand and said future medical is $100,000 because, after all, it's the future. It's a little hard to present the bills. And if that's not enough, we got to tell people.
I think you've got to evaluate the case on a case-by-case method. I think you've got to be able to tell practitioners that their experts can give opinions, but they've got to be based on the facts in the record or facts that they've stated that they've reviewed. They've got to have some scientific reliability, not just the, I think the moon is made from string cheese or whatever the situation was in that case. But it's got to be based on fact, and it's in order for it to be reliable. And I think that's going to vary from case to case on what the data the expert has to rely on, what factors he had to consider. And I don't think it's ever going to be implicit that in cases, and I can't think of an analogy to your case, but where the expert has got to use magic words such as capitalization rate or discount. different experts would calculate the value.
But this would also affect them. We've had for 100 years, the owner of the house or land can say the value of my property is $100,000.
Well, I...
Just let me finish.
I'm sorry.
For 100 years, we've said that's enough evidence. Mm-hmm. What you're... I'm gathering from this case is now after Daubert, in fact, that's not enough evidence. That owner is going to have to say why $100,000 is their valuation.
I don't think so. I think owners have already always been treated differently, owners of property, than experts who are strangers to the situation. And I think
so. Owners can give conclusory opinions, but experts can't. That's what you just said, I think.
I may have, yeah. I mean, it's their opinion based on what the value is to them, so it's not a conclusion. They're saying that I believe...
Experts saying an opinion, too.
Well, I just see it differently.
Here's the what obviously we're struggling with, is how do you determine what's speculative and conclusory on its face versus a methodology that underlies the opinion that's unreliable. So, for example, if you have an expert who says, okay, here's my damage figure, and I arrived at that by... doing a series of coin flips to determine various measures. Mm-hmm. Now, is that going to be conclusive or speculative on its face, or do you have to challenge the methodology because flipping coins is not reliable?
Well, I would challenge it in the trial court and at a minimum cross-examine.
Why does it have to be challenged?
The defendants here chose not to do either one.
Why does it have to be challenged if the burden's on you? Isn't that a burden, shift of the burden?
To show that the... that was the value, that was the... I guess in that situation, the point would be that's absolutely no evidence because it's based on a coin flip.
But the coin flip goes to the reliability mm-hmm. of the methodology that was used. Mm-hmm. Or can we just determine that on our own, that methodology was invalid?
I think sometimes it is just going to be a common sense approach that, you know, that's not a valid statistical way to evaluate a situation, and I'm not sure that a coin toss ever would be unless you're talking about the odds of heads or tails in a particular case. But I think
so if that's the case, then if we say that not determining a capitalization rate makes it speculative, then why wouldn't that fit under the same scenario? But it's like a coin toss, and so we can just tell that without the cap rate is speculative.
No, this is a different situation, I believe, Your Honor. This is a detailed analysis of quantifying and qualifying and the amount of reserves and then putting a dollar figure on it. And first of all, there is evidence in the record that talks about risk and would be evidence of capitalization and also discount. And I don't want to leave the impression that there's not. But when you take into account the capitalization rate, different experts might do it different ways. But the point is, he came to an opinion as to the value of the property, as the misrepresented value of the property, and the actual value of the property. Discounted the difference in that by 25%, which the jury could have inferred that included a capitalization rate. But in answer to your question, the capitalization rate is an element or part of the technique that the expert came to arrive at a number and is part of his methodology. It's not that the expert evaluated the Barnett Shale fields up near Dallas-Fort Worth as opposed to the Arkoma Basin in Oklahoma and said, based on this this evidence of the Barnett Shale and what I project, you know, based on how many wells have been drilled and how many, you know, all of this, there's this much reserves and it was worth this in California, you know, sometime. That might be the kind of thing you could say there was no evidence of. But here, they're on its face, the evidence is probative. You can look at the evidence in the record, and the jury could have based its finding on that. And because of that, the opposing party should have either objected, taken the witness on voir dire, let the trial court know somehow that there was an objection to this testimony as being no evidence, in order to preserve the right to complain to the Court of Appeals about the evidence.
In some of our cases, we have been concerned that if there's no contemporaneous objection, the other side doesn't have a chance to fix it, a fair chance to fix
right.
it. Is that involved here or not?
I think it's definitely involved here. This was a conscious decision because Harper was also a witness who detailed the extensive fraud that was involved in this case.
He was on the stand for a long time.
Yes, and a lot of it was his talking about how the reserves that Arkoma had used had been falsified. I think there was a conscious decision not to cross-examine him any further. Furthermore, there was data, which Justice Brister referred to earlier, that reports that he relied on, that he could have testified specifically, yes, I relied on these reports, which the trial court later reviewed, sort of on the other end of the trial and to the front end to determine the reliability of the testimony. So if there had been a proper objection raised in the trial court, not only could the trial court have corrected the error, but if it had happened contemporaneously, as you're suggesting, much more detail could have been gone into regarding his methodology, what was the basis, the specifics. But
thank,
we cited the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. Are there any further questions?
May it please the Court. Value is a subjective judgment. The law establishes certain means by which that subjective judgment can be arrived at, the various approaches to the ascertainment of value. An owner is permitted, is presumed to have a basis for an opinion as to value, as an overriding legal presumption.
Have we said so since Havner?
Don't believe you have. But
I mean, that's, we used to think that about experts in general until it just got out of hand.
I suppose that's so. In any event, prior to Havner, the owner at least was presumed, and maybe is still presumed, I don't know, today, to have a basis. But an expert is not presumed to have a basis. If this were an eminent domain case, and the evidence was, I'm an expert, I've looked at this, and the value of the property is $1 million, pass the witness. That would be no evidence of value. Without...
Do we have to amend rules, the expert witness rule that says you can do just that?
No, it's not a question of admissibility. That evidence is admissible because it is a predicate to the explanation of the basis that then gives it probative value. If we had stood up and objected, said Mr. Harper cannot say what his value is until he has given his basis, that would have been not a good objection under the rule and under Birchfield. But we waited for the basis to come. And the evidence that Mr. Harper put in was admissible evidence. He took 8 years' worth of cash flow and valued the reserves based on that.
But again, 705A then continues to say the expert may, in any event, disclose on direct exam or be required to disclose on cross-exam the underlying facts. If, in fact, the expert must disclose underlying facts, we need to amend Rule 705A.
I would submit that the Texas Rules of Evidence deal with admissibility, not with sufficiency.
But they mislead people if they say, well, you can do it, but you don't have to.
That's arguably so, but I think if you recognize that they are admissibility rules.
How about when the doctor says, value this surgery is going to be $50,000?
Well, the question then becomes, is the rest of his testimony such that it is clear that he is basing that on the treatment that in reasonable medical probability will be required? If that's so, then he's given an adequate basis.
So all the doctor has to say is $50,000.
Right. But if you just put the doctor on the stand and say, have you studied the plaintiff? Do you know what his future medical is? Yes, it's $50,000. Pass the witness. I don't think that's enough. I think if he's testified to his examination and his understanding of the patient's condition, then it may be enough.
Could you hit for just a moment? I love this point of whether a order of remittiture extends the appellate deadlines.
I would be happy to, Your Honor. This court has said in a number of cases that the deadlines are controlled by signed written orders of the trial court.
Anything that changes the judgment.
Anything that changes the judgment.
An order of remittiture doesn't technically change the judgment.
It does not change the judgment.
But we know for a fact the judgment will change.
No, we don't.
You have two options on a suggestion of remittiture, right? One is a new trial, and one is to cut the judgment.
That's what the judge is saying at the time he signs that order. But what if he orders a remittiture, the plaintiff doesn't file it, and he never gets around to signing an order granting a new trial?
So you're asking, what if the judge lied when he said these are your two options?
Not if he lied. What if he forgot? What if I failed to exercise due diligence?
Assume with me that the judge meant what they said. You have two options. We're going to try the case over, or you can take a smaller judgment. We know for a fact the judgment's going to change.
Technically it's not. Technically, the judgment today is as big as it ever was. The plaintiff has merely filed an instrument that precludes him from enforcing the judgment to the extent of that excess. The judgment today is for $4.7 million. There is merely an instrument that prevents $1.8 million, or now that the Court of Appeals has dealt with it, $300,000, from being collected.
What harm would there be to saying that they do extend the judgment, the time for post-judgment motion?
There's seldom any harm in saying, here are the rules, now go follow them. And if that were in the rules, that would be okay. But what the rules and what this Court's opinions have said is, only when the judgment has changed does the clock start over.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the Court will take a brief recess.